young Nigerian girl is released from a British immigration detention center after 2 years of horrific confinement. She knows the name of only one person in Britain. Unfortunately, his suicide coincides with her arrival. Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and today I'm going between the lines of Little B with award-winning British novelist Chris Cleave. Chris is a young novelist as well as a columnist for The Guardian newspaper in London. Chris has been a bartender, a long-distance sailor, teacher of marine navigation, and an internet pioneer. His debut novel, Incendiary, about a London bomb plot, was an international bestseller in spite of the notoriety for the bizarre coincidence of its release on the very same day of the London terrorist bombing on July 7th in 2005. Nevertheless, the book won several awards, among them the U.S. Book of the Month Club's First Fiction Award. Today's featured book, Little B, was shortlisted for the United Kingdom's prestigious Costa Best Book Award, and in 2009 for the Commonwealth Writers' Prize for Best Book. Little B is also in development as a feature film. Chris Cleave, I am just delighted to welcome you today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Little B is really a very gripping story of a young Nigerian girl, a refugee from the oil wars, as you say, of her country, Nigeria. And she's fled to England as a stowaway on a cargo ship. Describe the environment in Nigeria that she was fleeing from.
Sure, yeah. So Nigeria, I should say, is an amazing and very varied country. It's a country that has lots of different ethnicities, where lots of different languages are spoken, where there's lots of different geographies, really. There's a lot of farmland, some mountains, a lot of mangrove areas, beaches. The area I'm talking about is in the south of Nigeria, in an area that's called the Delta. And in the 1950s and 60s, they discovered oil in these Delta areas. And as it has in common with so many other places in the world, when oil arrives, trouble arrives soon after. Unfortunately, in that part of Nigeria, the way in which oil has been exploited, largely by Western oil companies, is incredibly environmentally destructive. So much oil has leaked out. There's so much pollution that when you see those, when you see images of that area, you understand that it's not farmable anymore and it's not fishable anymore. There's no real way for the people who live there to make a natural living anymore. In fact, the only money that's being made is being made in oil, and it isn't going back to the people who live there. So there's a lot of conflict that comes from poverty and anger at the fact that the local people haven't got any of their own birthright, which is the oil. You know, that's all being pumped out and they get nothing in return. So there's a lot of conflict in that part of the country, and there's a lot of corruption, and there's a lot of violence. And so Nigeria, while it's a very civilized and sophisticated country in many parts, in just that particular part of the south of Nigeria, produces a lot of refugees. So Nigeria, for example, is Africa's second largest exporter of refugees to the United Kingdom.
People seeking asylum.
That's right, mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's against that backdrop that Little B lives, and it's from that conflict that she's fleeing when she first meets Sarah, an English woman with whom she will become connected.
Well, Little B had this dream to get out of Nigeria, to get to England as a stowaway, but she ends up in a detention center. Now, you worked for a short time in a British detention center when you were younger. Describe that detention center and the one that Little B finds herself in, and talk about the differences, if there are any.
Oh, great question. It was in 1992 that I worked just for 3 days in a British immigration detention center. And that was quite by chance that I did that. I was working summer jobs in the holidays from university, and I would take on any job, really. And I ended up working in the kitchens of this immigration detention center, preparing food and serving it to refugees. And it was a great shock to me. You know, it was a shock to realize that these people who had committed no crime, they weren't even accused, obviously, of committing a crime, were imprisoned like this. And it was a prison, you know. That really shocked me. Before then, we didn't used to imprison asylum seekers and refugees. There have always been issues with dealing with people's paperwork, and I accept that. What I find very difficult to accept is the way that they're corralled into these prisons and not given a release date.
What was the average time maybe that the people spent in the detention center?
So I can't speak exactly to the average time that people spend in these places, but I have talked with people about the time that they spent. Now, I just want to be clear that I'm not an expert, but I've met people who've spent times between 2 weeks and 4 years in these places. And I believe the longest anyone stayed in that regime is sort of four to five years.
Mm.
And I'd like to stress again what that does to the mental health of someone who is innocent, who hasn't done anything wrong. And more to the point, is probably fleeing from something horrific that's happened
to them.
So they probably arrive in a post-traumatic state. You know, they're incredibly vulnerable people, and to lock them up, even in prisons that have quite a humane regime inside, is still a form of torture, in my opinion.
Was this one of the catalysts for writing Little Bee?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I was so shocked because I went to work in this place just for a little while, completely by accident. What I was shocked by was not just the fact that it existed, but the fact that I had no idea that it existed, and I would never have known if I hadn't accidentally taken this job there.
Mm.
The place that I worked in was called Campsfield House, and it was just outside Oxford. And that was the first immigration prison in the United Kingdom, or an immigration detention centre, as they call it, back in 1992. Because, as I say, we didn't used to detain these people.
Right.
And now there are 10, right? So they're building these centres all the time. There are more and more of them. And I really felt that it was a situation that was, you know, not just an aberration, that this was a real and growing situation, and I really should write about it, because one of the things that I think you can do in fiction is to take an issue that people won't necessarily know about and help them to live
right.
it, you know, help them to see it with eyes that are on the ground there.
You know, there was a very poignant story that I read on one of your blogs or your interview that struck you also as to the necessity for saying something, and it was about a man that hung himself.
Oh, yeah. Should I tell that story?
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Please.
So another reason that I really wanted to write this book was the story of a real refugee, and his name was Manuel Bravo, and he was a refugee from Angola, and he came to the United Kingdom because, for whatever reason, I don't know the details, he had got on the wrong side of the regime in Angola, and he believed, I think with some justification, that he would be killed if he was returned to Angola. He'd managed to get away, and he'd managed to get away with his son, who was 13 years old at the time that the story takes place. And they had put in their application for asylum. You know, they weren't what's called illegal immigrants. They were legitimate asylum seekers. They'd put in their paperwork. And they were living in a town in the north of England. And they were seized from their beds, Manuel Bravo and his son, in a dawn raid. And they were taken to an immigration detention centre called Jarl's Wood, which is one of the immigration prisons in the UK. And they were told that their asylum application had failed. They weren't going to be given leave to remain in the United Kingdom. And so they were going to be forcibly deported back to Angola the next morning. So Manuel Bravo, being a smart guy, a resilient guy, and a loving father, actually did the only thing that was left available to him, as all of those things, and which was that he hanged himself. He hanged himself from the stairwell of Jarl's Wood Immigration Detention Prison. They found him the next morning, and they had to take him down. And he was dead, and they had to break the news to his son. Now, the reason he had taken his own life was because, being a smart guy and a loving father, he had done his homework, and he had learned that there's a rule that the British state will not forcibly repatriate an unaccompanied minor. Right? Mm. So he had taken his own life in order to save his son's life. Right? That's how much he loved his son.
Because he knew if he went back that they were going to
that they would both die. Killed. Yeah. That yeah. To save one of them, he'd killed himself. In fact, he wrote a note to his son. His last words to his son were, "Be good, work well, try hard at school." And these are the people that we are repatriating because what? Because they don't share our values, you know? I just felt that he did, and I should write about that.
But I wonder, because I've heard that, well, many asylum seekers in the past were, you know, looked upon as heroes when they were defecting from Russia or from Nazi Germany or whatever. Yet it seems that the African Caribbean asylum seekers are treated with almost disdain.
Yeah.
Why do you know?
Well, I think there's three things going on, actually. We were brought up to think of asylum seekers as heroes. We called them defectors.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And every single one that defected from east to west was proof of the... that there was something, at least in the way we lived, that people were prepared to risk jumping over the Berlin Wall for, right? Risking their lives for. And then something changed, yeah. And by the early 90s, we were locking people up who came to our countries seeking refuge and trying to find new and interesting bureaucratic ways of repatriating them without making our own consciences feel too heavy. What's changed? One thing that's changed is definitely the ethnicity of the people involved, right? The people who are coming to Europe now seeking asylum aren't from the former Soviet Union, from the Eastern Bloc. They are from Africa and from the Middle East. So the big points of origin for asylum seekers are now, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, East Africa, and Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan. That's where they come from. So there's a clear ethnic difference now between the indigenous population of Britain, I guess, or the majority indigenous population, and the people who are presenting as refugees. So I think that's one factor that unfortunately plays to the more negative elements in society. I think it's not all about racism, though. I think there are two other factors coming into play. I think one is that there was political capital to be gained by the West accepting asylum seekers from the East during the Cold War. So it was proof of the moral superiority of our system, and it made politicians feel good in a way that immigration from neutral countries, from countries that we're not at war with, doesn't make us politically feel good. I think the third factor going on is the volume. I think people aren't coming and presenting as asylum seekers in ones and twos.
Right.
They're presenting in hundreds and thousands because there's a lot more conflict in the world. You know, and one of the reasons there's a lot more conflict in the world is because we're going to war a lot. You know, a lot of these refugees come from countries where we've recently started wars ourselves, right? So we shouldn't perhaps be surprised that war has a human cost in refugees. It has always been thus.
Well, let's talk about Little B now. We're introduced to Little B as she fantasizes about being money, an English pound, if you will. I really liked that introduction. Would you mind reading that first page?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Most days, I wish I was a British pound coin instead of an African girl. Everyone would be pleased to see me coming. Maybe I would visit with you for the weekend. And then suddenly, because I'm fickle like that, I would visit with the man from the corner shop instead. But you would not be sad, because you would be eating a cinnamon bun or drinking a cold Coca-Cola from the can, and you would never think of me again. We would be happy, like lovers who met on holiday and forgot each other's names. A pound coin can go wherever it thinks it will be safest. It can cross deserts and oceans and leave the sound of gunfire and the bitter smell of burning thatch behind. When it feels warm and secure, it will turn around and smile at you, the way my big sister Nikiruka used to smile at the men in our village in the short summer after she was a girl, but before she was really a woman, and certainly before the evening my mother took her to a quiet place for a serious talk. Of course, a pound coin can be serious too. It can disguise itself as power or property. And there is nothing more serious when you are a girl who has neither. You must try to catch the pound and trap it in your pocket so that it cannot reach a safe country unless it takes you with it. But a pound has all the tricks of a sorcerer. When pursued, I have seen it shed its tail like a lizard so that you are left holding only pence. And when you finally go to seize it, the British pound can perform the greatest magic of all. And this is to transform itself into not one, but two identical green American dollar bills. Your fingers will close on empty air, I'm telling you.
Wow. That last line. Your fingers will close on empty air. I guess that's about how the value of the dollar is going these days.
Well, the pound too, you know, the pound's going south. I think we're all in this together.
Well, this first page really does give us a sense of Little Bee's mind and her zeal and her quest for freedom.
Sure.
You know, if you've just tuned in, I'm going to tell you that you're listening to Valerie Jackson, and I'm going between the lines with Chris Cleave and his novel Little Bee, a story that exposes the hidden world of refugees and the sinners that detain them, as well as a young girl's quest for freedom. This quest for freedom is why she reached out to the only person that she knew. Actually, she didn't even really know the person. She knew his name, Andrew O'Rourke. Do you want to lay the groundwork for us here?
Yeah, sure. Little Bee is an amazingly resilient little girl. She's clever. She's funny. She's sometimes wise and sometimes incredibly naive in the way that teenagers are. And like a lot of teenagers, she doesn't really believe in death. She doesn't really believe that she could ever possibly die herself. And she will fight like a tiger to live. I mean, that's what I really liked about her as a character, her amazing resilience, her amazing ability just to take whatever chance she's given, however small that appears to be, because if it's her only chance, that's what she's going to do. And the reason that she turns up on the doorstep of this London couple called Sarah and Andrew O'Rourke is because in the scene where they originally met, in a scene of considerable conflict on a Nigerian beach where Sarah and Andrew are on holiday, because Ebino Beach in Nigeria is a holiday destination, but it's within a few days' walk of this place where there's a lot of conflict and trouble over oil. So they meet in a situation where Sarah and Andrew are on holiday, and Little Bee is fleeing for her life. Mm. It's one of the few places in the world where that could happen. And Andrew O'Rourke happens to drop one tiny piece of identification on that beach during the struggle that happens in this scene, which is his driving license. And that's the thing that Little Bee picks up. And that's the only link she has that links her to a couple from the West. And she pursues that one link, the tiniest, tiniest chance. Pursues it, keeps this card in her pocket for 2 years while she's in the immigration detention center. When she gets to the UK and when she gets out of the detention center, on the morning that the story of the book really starts, she's holding this one tiny piece of ID, this one little name, a little link between her world and ours. Mm. And that's where the story starts. That's the tiniest of straws that she's clung to. And it looks as if it might be enough.
The book is in two voices, Sarah's and Little Bee's. Why did you choose to do two narratives, and why two women?
I chose two narrators because when you're talking about a refugee story, you're talking about someone moving from one world to another. You're talking about people crossing these boundaries that aren't normally crossed. So boundaries of nationality, boundaries of ethnicity, boundaries of language, and emotional boundaries and boundaries of social norms that people don't normally cross. And when you cross those boundaries, you're always going through some kind of a wall, you know, often an invisible wall. But the view from the two sides of that wall is startlingly different. So the view of the West that you get from a country that's war-torn, you know, if you're a refugee trying to get into the West, You see that barrier, right? You really see all of the obstacles in between you and freedom and help. And it might look like a huge concrete wall, might maybe literally like a concrete wall. That's Little Bee's perspective when she looks in on this beautiful bubble that we all live in here in the West. Actually, when you look at that wall from the other side, you hardly notice that it exists. Mm-hmm. When you look at it from our point of view or from the perspective of Sarah O'Rourke in the book, she hardly notices it's there. And it isn't until she meets Little Bee that she has any conception that there is a barrier between our world that we live in America, Canada, Europe, Australia, these countries where we pretty much have everything we need, and this other world that is just asking, sometimes not for anything in particular other than fairness and understanding, mm-hmm. you know. So the view from those two sides of all of those boundaries, the emotional ones, the physical ones, the ethnic ones, the national ones, the views look very different. So as a writer, and especially as a writer who loves writing in the first person, mm. you know, I love being with my characters. I love putting the reader almost as a co-pilot in the thoughts of a character. So, you know, you're always asking the reader, you know, what would you do here? Because we need to land this thing together.
Right.
You know, I love writing in the first person. So if you want to show the view from the two sides of those mm-hmm. boundaries, you have to take two voices, not one. So I wanted to take Little Bee's voice and Sarah's voice. So I narrate the book in alternate chapters from their points of view, because I think that a true story emerges in the interface between those two fictions, mm-hmm. right, between Little Bee's mm-hmm. and Sarah's. There's an emotional truth that they get to between them that neither of them could arrive at together. So that's why I do the split narration. And why are they both women was the second part of the question. Well, in those kinds of conflicts that I was researching, the kind of conflict that Little Bee is fleeing from, one of the very sad and difficult to deal with things about these conflicts is that when someone wins, most of the males who survive are conscripted into that winning side, right? So they become combatants of whatever militia or government unit or whatever has won the skirmish. And even very young boys. I mean, this is very sad. I mean, everyone's familiar with these stories about child soldiers. These are the boys. Well, terrible things happen to the females too. But it is possible for a surviving female non-combatant to exist, you know, for a female to survive and not be conscripted into an army. And I felt that Little Bee was more likely to be a woman, you know, to be female as a survivor.
Listen, I wanted to ask you about why English was so important to Little Bee. Language was very special and crucial to her. Talk about that a moment, if you will.
Yeah, so I'm obsessed with language, obviously, as a writer, and I'm I'm obsessed with the different registers of English. Nigerian English, I became obsessed by. It's so good because it's a language that was imposed as a lingua franca by a colonial power on a country that didn't necessarily want it, but found it expedient to use it. There's a lot of politics that are enshrined in Nigerian English.
Right.
So sometimes Nigerians want to speak it because it's useful, and sometimes they want to speak it precisely so that English people won't understand it. So it's English plus thousands of words of extra vocabulary that are taken from the original languages of that area, right? Which can acquire more or less of a flavor in the way that the language is spoken.
I was just going to say, in the story, Little Bee talks about how you either have to use your looks or you have to use language, or something to that effect.
Yeah.
And so her weapon was language, and boy, was she good at it.
Yeah, right. So she works out this thing that I think is probably true in today's modern cities, is that the way we judge each other now is on the way we speak. So I think we live mercifully in a world where the biggest single indicator of the kind of person you are is the way you use a language. And she works out that in order to become accepted in London, in Britain, she has to change the way she speaks English to the way that people speak English in England. And she plays with that. She plays games with it. And she plays tricks, actually, on the English people in the book as she's going through.
The major theme, I think, in the book, though, is one that we probably don't have time to go into, but I do want the readers and the listeners to think about it. And that is, Little B comes to Sarah for help. And the question really becomes, how much help are we obligated to give people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the central question of the book. How much, if you're one of those people that's been blessed with a with happiness to whatever extent, you know, if you have a life that's to whatever extent comfortable, how much do you owe to the people who are less lucky? You know, it's a really simple question, and it's one that we all of us address every day. You know, every time, for example, that we walk past a homeless person and we give them a dollar instead of all our money, right, then we have found an answer to that question. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the right answer or the wrong answer, mm-hmm. I don't know, and I'm not judging. Right. You know, I'm just trying to pose the question in this book in an interesting way, and I always try to pose questions in an extreme way. So in this question, Sarah, for example, is presented with a choice. How much of her comfortable life is she going to give up to save the life of someone who will die, literally physically die in front of her, if she doesn't give up something quite significant of herself? Most of us aren't pushed to that extreme in our lives, but that doesn't mean we aren't answering the same question
right.
every day.
Right, in our small decisions yeah. that we make. Right,
and that's what I try to do in my fiction. I try to take a big moral question that all of us live every day, and a lot of us come up with good answers to it. You know, it's not a judgmental book. I'm not saying people should do more. As an artist, I'm really interested in exploring, you know, what the boundaries of compassion are and how exciting love is. You know, I mean, love in the platonic sense
right.
between human beings, when those boundaries are crossed and people for whatever reason decide that today I'm going to do more. You know, today I'm going to do more than is necessary and throw caution to the wind and see what happens. Mm. And, you know, I guess the question I pose in my work is like, what are the circumstances of the human
right.
heart
yeah.
in which we will make that leap of love?
Yeah. Thank you, Chris, so much. I've enjoyed this conversation.
Me too. Thank you.
I've been talking with Chris Cleave, and his latest book is Little B. To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, go to our website at wabe.org/BTL and listen to an archived program. Or check out our suggested reading list for both children and adults. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to our website and click on Podcast. Be sure to join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go Between the Lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor and technical producer, Mike Johns. Assistant producer, Colin Baylor. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Between the Lines is a production of 90.1 WABE.